Hello and welcome to Niaga Spotlight with me, Tamina Kausji. Niaga Spotlight goes through the week in business and future affairs, bringing you market watch, analysis and insights. Today, of course, just ahead of the Budget 2024 tabling later this afternoon, we're taking a look back on the year that has been for the Malaysian economy, looking at key allocations. What have the outcomes been so far for the fantastic in-house studio panel of course, Dr. Soraya Ismail, Director of Research with Khazana Research Institute, KRI, Ding Hong Sing, National President with SME Malaysia, and rounded off with Lee Yun Han, Consulting Director with Deloitte, Southeast Asia. Welcome to studios. Thank you so much for making time for us ahead of Budget 2024. How's everyone doing?
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for having me here today.
Fantastic. Dr. Soraya, I'd love to get started off with us speaking a little bit more about housing, a key area of interest when it comes to some of the Budget 2024 calls for action, which include reinstating home ownership campaign. KRI's thoughts on this.
Thank you, Tamina. Undoubtedly, in terms of housing, ownership is a very important factor. However, I think we have to ensure as well that, you know, prices of houses are affordable to begin with, so that people can actually buy these houses without highly financialization of these homes by having, you know, very expensive mortgages, so that, you know, these houses appear to be affordable. But at the same time, I think we're also missing a huge part of the discussion, which is what about rental? Because home ownership should go together with rental. And it should not go as if one is a priority over the other, or rental shouldn't be an option when houses are too expensive. So, what are we doing for rental? Rental has been ongoing for a lot of years in our country, yet we do not have a proper Rental Tenancy Act to govern the rental between owner and the person who rent. So I think this is something that we could also look into, because this alone, the absence of it, can cause problems in supervising housing rental market, particularly when the market is dominated by speculative holders and landlords who will have mortgage obligations because they have the tendency to determine unreasonable rental prices for substandard residential spaces. Now, before incentives and subsidies are given by the government, because it's the budget, right? We need to first ensure that there are affordable homes to purchase. And then this home ownership campaign incentives would not be a smart move when the market is currently flooded with overhangs and unsold units. So the market correction can be not just for primary housing units, but also secondary, because we can see there's a lot of vacant properties in Malaysia, about 1.3 million vacant properties which are vacant in Malaysia now. So I think one should look into it in terms of, yes, home ownership campaign, but with affordable prices, and also look into rental as a way to provide shelter as well.
Definitely. So it has to be a lot more holistic and integrated, particularly looking at the fact that cost of living is increasing. And definitely this year has been a key year. Moving along from there into tax, another big block of a topic. Yun Han, so do you feel that the scheduled implementation of previously announced capital gains tax, CGT, on non-listed shares, luxury goods tax, can this help to fund Malaysia's massive pension bill as a rapidly aging nation? We've also got the targeted petrol subsidies, which have been creating quite a stir.
Yep. So I think when it comes to Malaysia as an aging nation, right, it is something that needs to be looked at a bit more longer term, right? And I think by, if I'm not mistaken, by 2025, we would expect that at least 15% of Malaysia's population will be above the age of 65. And that's talking about nearly 5 million Malaysians being above the age of 65. So that would then have longer term consequences on the impact to society from the healthcare perspective and also productivity standpoint, right? You're going to see a shrinking labour force as a result. So therefore, I believe that the government does need a longer term plan that will actually help the aging population for them to live better and continue to be productive even post-retirement, right? And to me, this goes beyond post-retirement savings or pension plans even, right? Because in other markets where we see aging populations, they are taking steps to activate this population, not just from a healthcare standpoint, but also from a workforce productivity standpoint. Because the elderly, they do have a lot of extensive experience that can benefit the younger generations in terms of skills development, coaching, and so on and so forth. And on top of that, the elderly should also have the option, if they so choose to take on jobs that provide a living wage in a safe environment to keep them physically and mentally active as well, right? So in Japan, for example, they are looking at, because they're already an aged nation, the government does provide incentives, policies that encourage retaining and rehiring the older workforce, and even down to the extent of providing subsidies around workplace restructuring of the infrastructure to be safer for the elderly to come back to work, right? And even when it comes to, let's say, Singapore, because we are also concerned around the elderly who may not have enough savings to sustain the longer years in life. They do provide what they call the Silver Support Scheme that provides financial assistance that are targeted towards elderly at the low income level. So to me, it's something that, yes, the tax breaks or the subsidies can help fund many things, but we do need a longer term plan when it comes to tackling the issue around the aging population here.
Absolutely. It cannot be something which we're looking at as a stopgap measure and just as a so-called budget goodie. Mr. Ding, I want to ask you about GST. What do you think about the reintroduction for GST, especially from an SME Malaysia perspective?
Okay, GST is a good thing. It's a video that tests the SMEs, mean the benefit for the low GST. Mm-hmm. Make the because the world will have to pay the less the tax and the product and the service this can call to help them to save money. Therefore, the GST is for the tax is for the very everybody have the same. You expect more, you can tax more. I hope this the GST is for the our business people is a good for the 4%, but it's don't increase until the 6%. But this GST, because it's easy for the our businessmen to calculate input and output. And also it's for the, so no good, good thing one, it's very important the government is being the test and then the pay the tax, the refund the tax. At least it's 30 days to refund back. It's not refund back. Our SME is cash flow is very tight.
Understand. So right now, how long was the refund taking in the previous time when we had this GST that was causing problems for SMEs?
Because the I think last time have the GST because the refund back because our SME, the cash flow, the financing is very tight. But it take a few months, some it take 10 months, 1 year also have. It is a very difficult for the our SME for the funding because our SME is a fund, cash flow is very tight.
Understand.
I hope the government is one to set out the, this GST and also it need the 30 days to refund back our business people.
Making those parameters a lot stricter. Thank you, Mr. Ding. Moving on into job opportunities and wages. Yun Han, let's look at human capital development allocations, some of which have, of course, been highlighted in Budget 2023, and your perspective on how they can have a more strategic impact when it comes to one of our fundamentals, the workforce.
I think when we looked at like Budget 2023, for example, right, and the last year's budget, I'm encouraged to see allocations when it comes to skills development at the end of the day, because when it comes to the workforce and upskilling and also higher incomes, it comes back towards fundamentally the marketable skills that are required by industry in order for them to gainfully be employed and also to command higher wages on that, right? So the thing is that what I'm hoping to see for the next year's budget is that when we look at skills or investments into skills development, we do need to be much more granular and clearer when it comes to the policy direction, right? So what are the key skills, key jobs that Malaysia is looking at that then we are allocating budgets, programs towards, and what sort of jobs are we gearing up to, right? So for instance, when it comes to TVET, for example, right, we do have, I think, just over 50 colleges in TVET that offer courses in EV, for example, right? And I think one is being built or proposed to be built in Johor in 2026. So the question is, right, is that enough? Do we need more? Where are these people going when they graduate? Is the quality sufficient? And are they able to be placed into jobs that have higher level of incomes befitting these kind of next generation emerging technology jobs as well, right? So ultimately, it comes back to skills to drive that capacity to earn. And the good news is that I see that the private sector is increasingly looking at skills as a means to pay, right? So instead of just, I pay this much for a job, but I'm looking at skill sets, how much are these skills worth in the market, and paying for a person's collective skills coming to into the work that needs to be done, right? And this helps them be more flexible in attracting, retaining talent based on skills. And at Deloitte, we call this the shift towards being a skills-based organization, right? Thinking of how they recruit, retain based on skill sets and not traditional jobs is how we look at it, right? So that's on the skills part. I think there's also allocations when it comes to social security, job worker welfare as well. And I believe that is needed because with the rise of technology, it is good for productivity, but at the same time, safeguards are needed from a worker, you know, safety, security standpoint, because technology platforms like the gig economy and so on and so forth tend to blur the lines between what we call contract of service versus contract for service, the employer and independent contractor, right? And I believe that the employers and individual employees need clear guidelines, guardrails that prevent worker exploitation, because we want to ensure that they can live their lives in full, right? Now we see remote working as well, right, being on the rise. That's good news in some sense that Malaysians can then work from Malaysia for jobs overseas remotely, right? But at the same time, there are jobs in Malaysia being then offshore to another remote worker somewhere around the world as well, right? So it still comes down to what skills do we need to be competitive in the marketplace here in Malaysia.
Very interesting indeed. And Dr. Suraya, if I could quickly pick up there, what KRI's perspectives insofar have been on the proposed progressive wage model, PWM, which of course would be able to translate all of these benefits with regards to wages to those from the lower income sectors?
Yes, this is a very important factor about the returns to labour. We've done some work on the returns to labour with the absence of minimum wage that was introduced by the government. And it appears that without government coming in and telling businesses to increase wages for the bottom 50%, wages have been stagnating. The baseline is that for the past 10 years, for the bottom 50 of our population, we only see real increment of about 56 RM per year. So that's for 50% of our population. Now, the minimum wage was a huge move to then make sure that labour is being, given the right wage scale for the productivity that they have given. And the other thing is that even when productivity is going up, it appears that some businesses are not rewarding or not giving the right amount or sufficient amount of returns to labour. And that's why we see a lot of our people physically going to other countries, which is not really a bad thing, but we lose that talent because we are not paying them enough wages. And therefore, this progressive wage model was introduced, but it was introduced voluntarily. This is when I think there should be some historical bent to this, because when it was centralised and minimum wage was given in terms of a fiat or a decree, it worked. So voluntary progressive wage model is something that needs a bit more stick to it rather than carrot, because what we don't want is we keep on losing our talent, Because the wages is too low. Now, we can say about upskilling, we can say about, you know, we have a good talent, but if they are not compensated with decent wages, we will lose this talent. So I'm hoping that in this budget, some level of understanding that the culture we seem to have is that if there is no direct intervention or push from the government, wages will still be stagnating.
And of course, that affects the purchasing power. Mr. Ding, I want to ask you about the many entrepreneur programs that there are for SMEs under Budget 2023. Any feedback from the ground? Because you, of course, as the national president, get to hear all these voices from different SMEs.
2023, the budget is a come out. I can't see anything have the budget for help our micro and the small SME. But though, I think 1 month ago, have the announced is 100 million, I listened, and the money also have the in the MIDF. The micro, the 50,000 to 200,000 can loan if 2%. This loan also, I very thank you for the government to take the this budget is come up. That what this one is, I think is not is a 2023 the budget. You only to look the help the micro is a lot of micro is a problem, but the case is a have don't have the funding to expand the business, and also micro many is a good product, but it's a financing had a problem. But also very thank you for the government is give the 100 million to borrow the micro 50,000 to 200,000. For the interest loan is 2%.
So there have been some injections. Now we wait and see whether or not they are going to be able to expand sufficiently. Dr. Suraya, moving from there into cash aid, I really wanted to ask you about looking at the recently announced AG report as well about the fact that we have ballooned our subsidies bill by almost 300% of late. But at the same time, however, we can't cut back too much on subsidies. KRI's perspectives.
I like this question. If you look at all of the statistics about households and businesses currently, we have not really gotten to the place that we were, you know, pre-pandemic. And exacerbated by the wars that we're having and the supply chain issues, businesses and households are not really at a place where I think it is stable and they have that resilience. So yes, government too are having problems in terms of financial fiscal space. So what do we do now? Okay, so government is looking into rationalizing key subsidy items next year. The impact will be felt, I think, if they actually do this, the impact will be felt. To what degree? That it will be cushioned off by the existing social protection schemes we have. So there must be some investment in social protection schemes. Wages must go up, but you know the businesses are not doing that well. So the balancing of all these levers must be looked upon very carefully by the government. So I think even when some incentives are being put in or mechanisms are being put in via the budget, we must actually look at the monitoring and tracking, because this is a very tricky situation. And I think we were discussing this before. If we don't do something this year, it's either businesses or households will really go, you know, down south. So we just need to do the right things, look at the combination of policy options we have, but at the same time, track the impact and see what works. Because times are a bit unstable, I think.
Exactly. And data, of course, helps to inform policy, right? And it also should for the budget itself. Yunhan, from there, I'd like to move into what has been a huge focus of the Madani government in particular, increasing women's labour force participation rate from the current fairly low compared to even our regional stats, 56% to 60%. Men's LFPR has always been a relatively strong 81% comparatively.
Yep. And I think for Malaysia, if we are not taking full advantage of the other half of the labour force, we are missing out a huge opportunity for growth and productivity as well, right? And one thing that when we looked at other countries in terms of labour force participation rate, most developed nations have what we call a double peak, right? So when women enter the workforce, as they reach an age where they start families, they tend to drop out the workforce. And over time, after a few years, they tend to come back as well. So that's what causes the double peak. Now, in the Malaysia context, what we tend to observe is a single peak, right? So as women reach, you know, between the ages of late 20s, early 30s, 35, then they start dropping off from the labour force and they don't come back to work, right? So now why is that, right? And there are a few reasons that I believe contributes to that area. One is that potentially the job itself of how it's designed is not flexible or doesn't cater towards the needs of a diverse range of workforce potentially, right? There could also be bias perceptions to things like gaps in experience, right? Someone with work experience continuously versus how do you explain 5 years of working experience gap, 7 years of working experience gap, and people or employers may be incentivized to then reach out or take employees of those without career gaps, right? And also, I think lack of access to affordable childcare tends to hold some people back, looking at how families are getting smaller, perhaps even more isolated. The social support network that people may have before may no longer be an option for some people, right? So ideally, we need to look at work environments that encourage women to return to the workforce in a capacity that befits their skills, their qualifications, and also with equitable pay. Right? It doesn't make sense, and we're not solving the problem if women only see low-value jobs as opportunities upon returning to work after, you know, having certain level of skill sets and qualifications. Right? So I believe that the recent government efforts to push things like affordable childcare subsidies when it comes to nursery fees, right, career comeback programs are definitely steps in the right direction. On top of that, certain reskilling programs that enable women to come back to work as well would be quite crucial, right? Because being up to date at the workforce, going through that and getting them up to speed on the latest in the industry does help ease them back into the workforce. And I believe that the private sector also plays a role in enabling this to happen, right? Because the jobs themselves need to be designed in a way that allows for flexibility. Now with the rise of hybrid work, remote work, this allows more opportunities for women to balance caregiving responsibilities as well as work, given that availability of technology. On top of that, on the private sector, we do need to encourage more women in leadership positions, right? And that would help create role models for women to look up to and also career paths that they can go towards to encourage them to come back to work, right? And so when we look at some of the Scandinavian countries like Denmark, Norway, Sweden, they do have very clear family-oriented, family-friendly policies at work, generous parental leave policies, very strong emphasis on gender equality and the work environment that's supportive, and all this has contributed to much higher LFPR among women in those countries as well.
Yeah. I hear you on all the points that you're speaking of. Let's talk about the missing component, perhaps. We have also recently increased paternity leave to become 7 days. However, at the same time, it's nowhere near the 98 days, which are now mandated for all women in Malaysia wanting to take maternity. So how do we fill that gap? Because there are already certain business chamber associations that have gone on the record saying they are not going to be that interested in hiring women since they can take maternity leave up to 98 days.
So, yeah, perhaps Mr. Ding, you want to take that on?
Okay, this one is a penny fee. I promoter is a garden the equality by the give the father as the must time as the mother to care for the newborn. Mm-hmm. There is a help share is a responsibility of children the more heavenly. Also, to request the woman to work, to come out to work, so the economy also can help the husband. Another one is also our can less the foreign workers. This is very important. Mm-hmm. It's a challenges. It's a challenges. It's a cost. You know the. You know, it's a, you take the 98 days. Our SME is a problem. It's a, this is a very challenges. And I say the company finance also is output product liability also less, and also a lot. You see, sometimes you know the baby, the sick, or sometimes have the problem. The many take the leave. But anyway, it's a. If my own opinion, I will must do that because I will want to less the foreign workers, use local workers.
So there has to be some balance.
Yes, yes, correct.
Another interesting part, Mr. Ding, can I ask you about the Women Business Financing Fund that under Budget 2023, Women Business Financing Fund for SMEs was announced and its value is about 235 million ringgit. So what do you think are some of the impacts on women-run SMEs as well? How are they doing in Malaysia? Do they have any challenges that they come to the SME association with?
Okay. 2023, the woman have the budget come out. But I never heard this the funding. But the government have the budget to come out that this funding. But many our member for the woman, the woman, the business people, they also ask me how to borrow the funding, borrow the money, because look, the government he have the this funding a lot, but cannot get the this borrow the this the money is the I hope the government is a transparent. Which part can borrow the this for the woman to do the business and
how do you that. Apply?
Yes, how to apply. Mm-hmm. But until today, also the woman to do the business still say the loan is the government don't have. But it's a budget I have, but I never didn't see, but not transparent. Maybe have, but don't know how to apply.
Right, so there's definitely a communication gap and that needs to be closed because as we do know, budget allocations, if they're not taken up during a previous year, there will definitely be a stronger inclination not to have them the next year.
Yes.
Moving along from there, Dr. Siraya, let's move into flood mitigation, natural disaster prevention, because this also has become a part of almost our daily lives, especially for those in urban centres in Malaysia. So when it comes to budget-related allocations for disaster readiness, does KRI feel that strengthening of government agencies, those allocations, when will we be able to see not just the impacts, but at the moment as well, we've been having quite a lot of flash floods due to the ongoing monsoon?
I think there's two things here. That's the mitigation coffers and the adaptation coffers. So I think rather than mitigate all the time, let's have some funding for adaptation. We are going through this, floods and other climate change incidences. I think we should have a climate adaptation policy, which the government has not gotten on doing it yet. So while we remain hopeful for this budget measure, we are not expecting anything. So the adaptation coffers is not there, but logic would suggest that if we start doing it now, it would be in terms of lower in terms of cost. But for flood mitigation measures geared to the current 1.1 degrees of warming will need to be assessed if they are able to handle 1.5 or more than 2 degrees Celsius of warming that the future may bring. So this is an example of what adaptation may demand. So that's for adaptation for current and for future. We would also like to see preventive measures to tackle sea level rise, since over 40% of our settlements, housing and businesses are in coastal areas. So there's no funding for that as yet. As for mitigation, while the current haze is due to fires in Indonesia, it is a reminder to protect and conserve our forests as they currently balance around 65% of our emissions and will cover over 90% in the future. So further allocation to the ecological fiscal transfer to states for conservation would be welcome, because if you don't have that incentive, you know, it might be just wiped off.
Yeah, and definitely building a little bit upon the 22B flood mitigation project that was just announced under RMK 12, the midterm review. Thanks so much, and so far, We take a quick break. We'll be right back with Niaga Spotlight, our Budget 2024 Roundtable Special. Don't go anywhere.